don't understand why Samsung was so much excited about, so much excited to the level of obsession about their string diagram. So I saw that they used it to prove that the teleportation protocol is correct. And some other protocols like entangled swapping are correct. On the string diagram, if I understand the germ moment is that if you do this, is equal to this. So if you do this, and this is equal to this. And you can see these guys there, because this and another one is equal to the line. You do one and juxtapose it with another one, then you get the same thing. So, and then when Jonathan Barrett came to Oxford to give a talk, where he said, like, these guys, string diagrams actually help to solve some, So he said that string diagrams have been used to solve some group theory problem related to TQFT, right? I couldn't care less. I didn't understand.
It's John Barrett.
John Barrett from Nottingham. Yeah. Actually, got into a fight with him. So because I saw it all the time, this kind of diagram thing. Western movies. I actually want to show something here. If I'm really cute, if it works. If not, I apologize in advance. See, that's how it works. Yanking. Okay, one more. Okay. In Western movies, you can also see them in when you eat lunch. In an Italian restaurant, when I comb my hair, water in the garden, nature, and even before men came to earth and they lived in heaven. Heaven, but what got me excited and interested in this kind of diagrams was the applications to analysis of syntax and semantics of natural languages, where you get diagrams like that. So that's what the talk is going to be about today. So here's the title, A Compact Categorical Approach to Distributed Meaning. This is joint work with Stephen Clark. He was the computational linguist of our lab in Oxford before he moved to Cambridge. Bob and Anne Frele, who's a student of Tarski and a close collaborator of Lambeth. So the story started when Stephen Clark actually came to us with an open question in computational linguistics, and we managed to solve it using this compact closed categories and the string diagram. So apologies to people who have seen this talk before. So linguists, if I understand it correctly, they try to analyze natural languages, and they assume that there is a grammar for every language, rules for the syntax, and there is a meaning to every word and every sentence. And some people, mathematicians, are interested in linguistics, and they try to find mathematical structures to analyze the syntax and semantics of natural languages. Examples of these structures are typological grammars. They use an algebra to analyze the syntax, where you assign grammatical types to the words of a phrase, and then compose them to get the type of the phrase. One other approach probably most of you are familiar with is the Chomsky way, that you write a set of rewrite rules to represent the grammatical rules of the language, and if you apply these rules, then you can generate the syntax of your language. So there's a big contrast between the two. On the semantic part, there is a symbolic model of meaning. When you assign sets, or if you want predicates, to the grammatical types, and then you use logical connectives to connect these sets. The formula where you get at the end, you count as the meaning of the natural language sentence. And this is opposite to the distributional or the vector space model of meaning, where you assign vectors to words in a high dimensional vector space, whose bases are either, in the worst case, all the words of a dictionary, but most of the time are chosen based on the domain in which you are looking for the meaning. Like if you're looking for the meaning of a sportive sentence, you only put sport words as the basis. So the problem here is that the symbolic model of meaning is compositional. It has a set theoretic semantics which lets us do automated inference about what sentence of natural language implies another sentence. But it's qualitative. The meaning of a sentence there is either true or false. So it doesn't say anything about the lexical semantics, the quantitative meaning of the words, and is not very suitable for real-world text because it's heavily based on the correctness or the grammaticalness, that the sentence that we are talking about its meaning has to be grammatical, whereas this is not the case most of the time in real-world text. If you want to analyze the semantics using the distributional model of meaning, the bad thing about it is that it's not compositional. You have the meaning of words, but there is no canonical way, there is no good way to compose the meaning of the words to get the meaning of the sentence. But it has a lot of other good things about it, that it's quantitative, and it's all about the lexical semantics. It actually gives you something meaningful about the meaning of words in a sentence. Now, Stephen Clark asks, how can we have a model of the meaning which has no cons? It's all pros. It's compositional, like the symbolic model of meaning, and quantitative, like the vector space model of meaning. And we are going to, we found a solution using compact cross categories, right? So we discovered that to make a compositional model of semantics, we should not close our eyes on the syntax. We'll have to bring an element from the syntactic structure of the sentence into the semantics. And for reasons that will become clear later, we're going to use the algebraic way of analyzing syntax. And we're going to use Lambeck's recent invention, pregroup, which is a partially ordered monoid in which every element has a left and a right adjoint. This is a reincarnation or an alternative to the old algebra used to analyze syntax, the syntax calculus of Lambeck from the 50s, where you work in a partially ordered monoid where the composition of the monoid had a left and right adjoint. So the passage is like going to compact clause here from monoidal clause there. So very roughly, if I want to analyze the sentence Google bought Microsoft, I'm going to assign a noun phrase. Google is a noun phrase. Microsoft is a noun phrase. Bought is a verb phrase. But if I put these things as types and I compose them using the multiplication of the monoid, like juxtapose them, I don't get anything meaningful on the right-hand side. What I want to be able to say is that this sentence is grammatical and it reduces to the type S of a sentence. So I have to be a bit smart about picking the right types for the verb. So I'm going to do a bit of thinking. What is a verb? It's something that meets a subject, a noun phrase on its left, a noun phrase on its right. And if you give these things to the verb in the right order, it will produce for you a sentence. And to get rid of these two, then you're going to use the fact that these are adjoints and these are adjoints. So a bit more on pregroups. This is a partially ordered monoid in which every element has a left and a right adjoint. So these are the equations for P having the right adjoint R and the left adjoint L. If you precompose with the left adjoint and postcompose with the right adjoint, you can reduce to one. So these guys are called contractions. And you can always expand a one to a P composed, postcompose with the left adjoint and precompose with the right adjoint. So these guys are called expansion. The unit and co-unit of the adjunction. Now, pregroups are very special. That the adjoints are antitone, they change the order. If P is less than Q, QL is going to be less than PL. And similarly for the right adjoint, it's not that surprising because you can always think of the adjoints as some kind of a negation. That the unit is self-adjoint maybe is a bit surprising, but not that much. But the most innovative thing about the pregroup is that the composition is also self-adjoint. So if I take the adjoint left or right of a composition, it will reverse the order, but that's normal, but it will not change the multiplication. So normally, if that was a conjunction, it would become a disjunction, but here it doesn't, stays the same. So that makes it a new mathematical structure worth studying on its own. Now, how do we use a free group to analyze syntax? Well, let sigma be the set of words in a natural language, and then you fix a set of grammatical types in your poset B, where there is some initial partial order between the types. For example, every noun can be a subject. Every pronoun can be a subject too. So you put some initial partial order between your types. And then you make a dictionary, a pre-group dictionary, by assigning to each word of the language sigma some types from the free pre-group generated on your partial order. So T of B is the free pre-group, and Lambeck has shown that it exists, and he has also shown how to construct it. Now, a pre-group grammar is now you take your types. So in your dictionary, you have the words, you have the grammatical types, and then you fix a set of designated types, alpha, and the pair, the dictionary and the designated types, is called the pre-group grammar. And then using these, you define a string of words, W1 to WN of sigma is grammatical, if and only if the types corresponding to them from the dictionary D, if you juxtapose them, then they will reduce to one of the designated types in alpha. Now that's the meaning of when a string of words in a language is grammatical. So for example, if I want to generate sentences, Bob likes beer, and Bob does not like beer, so I'm going to fix a set of types, N for noun, S for sentence, J for infinitive, and some sigma for a dummy variable of an index type. Then I can assign in my dictionary the type noun to Bob, to beer, to likes, I'm going to assign, as I explained before, an R, S, N, L, it's a verb, and to its infinitive, instead of an S, I'm going to put a J, and the types of does and not, let's not explain them now, but they look like that. So now if I want to show that the sentence Bob likes beer is grammatical, then I assign these types to the words, and I have to show that this reduces to S, which is a designated type, and it does, right? So you cancel this plot, and S stays in the middle. For Bob does not like beer, it's not that obvious a reduction. So now you can use the diagram. Now you can see that N goes to does, now does goes to not, does goes to, one more time, to not, and then not feeds something to like twice, and beer is also fed to like, and the sentence is generated from the auxiliary does here. So this is the syntactic structure of the sentence, Bob does not like beer. That is grammatical, we know, because we have one line coming out of the type sentence S, which is our one of our designated types. Is this clear? Yeah. Okay, so I don't have time to put more examples, but perhaps you'll be convinced because it has been applied, so it's been around three groups for probably not more than 10 years. But it has already been applied to type the grammar of many languages. So these are the normal ones, English, French, Italian, German, but also to Turkish, Arabic, Japanese. I did it for Persian. They have also done it on Chinese and Hebrew. And it went so swiftly that I could also analyze poems with this. So I picked poems from Omar Khayyam. And this is the diagram corresponding to that Rubai of Omar Khayyam, the quatrain, and this is the diagram. I've said this joke many times before, but I think I was lucky I picked the right poem, so the diagram is very symmetric. So the diagrams are also useful if you want to compare, get rid of the syntax, the words that you don't know how to read even, of different languages, and compare their grammatical structure. just by looking at their syntactic diagrams and figures. For example, I took the word, the one sentence, and a very rough calculation showed these structures the same in English and French, Arabic and Hebrew, Persian and Hindi. We don't have more time on this, but let's now move on from syntax to semantics. So for syntax, we fix this pre-group way of typing a language. Now on the semantic side, the symbolic model of meaning is very compositional. The meaning of a sentence is a function of the meaning of its constituents. And this big function of the meaning of a sentence is obtained by composing the meaning of the functions of the constituents of the sentence. Now this makes sense for things like a verb, which you can perfectly reasonably think of as relations, functions, but it doesn't make sense about nouns, adjectives, adverbs, etc. For example, the meaning of the sentence Google bought Microsoft is composed of the meaning of a noun phrase Google and a verb phrase, which in itself has a noun phrase Microsoft and a verb bought. This is perfectly reasonable. The tree shows the syntactic structure, but it doesn't say anything about the leaves, right? What is Microsoft? What is Google? Now compare this to the distributed model of meaning. And Stephen Clark, who is the expert in this field, he says that it can best be explained, or the idea behind it can best be understood by a quotation from Firth, that you shall know a word by the company it keeps, by the context in which it appears most of the time. So now here the intuition is that the meaning of the words beer and whiskey are similar because they both get you drunk, they are served at the pub, they have alcohol, they can damage your liver, they can cause a hangover if binged on, etc. Now one can come up with a lot of words like that, for example, cat and dog, sheep and boat. And the facts, these facts that the words have a similar meaning are reflected in the text in which they appear. For example, beer and whiskey both appear close to the words drunk, pop, alcohol, binge, hangover, etc. Now, to model this way of thinking about the meaning of words, we're going to build a vector space whose bases are some words from a dictionary, the semantic space, and we're going to fix the context of an n-word window and count how close the words, how many times the words appear in this context close to the bases that we fix. For example, if we want to make the vectors of beer and alcohol over the bases hangover, binge, and pop, then we get these two guys. And the yellow one is beer or whiskey. Beer, yeah. I've never heard binging over whiskey. But yeah, beer, and the green one is the yellow one is whiskey, beer, and the green one is whiskey. And this is a perfectly good way to compare the meaning of these two words, right? So people do not agree. Whenever I explain this to anyone, they come up quickly with sharp counterexamples, but it works. So a guy called Curran said, I'm going to once and for all make all the counterexample makers silent. So he wrote a program to create pairs of synonym words from 2 billion words of text using the distributed model of meaning. And then did it work? And you can judge for yourself. So to introduction, the program found launch, inclusion, creation, arrival as synonyms, to evaluation, assessment, examination, appraisal, to method, technique, procedure, tactic. Can't get any better, I would say. Why is the opposite? Yeah, so I asked the same question in introduction about creation. So I asked Stephen Clark, why introduction is the same as creation? And then he said, if you open the Bible, the first sentence you see that the world is created by the Word, and that's the introduction to the Bible. So some argument like that. I mean, you pick the one that maybe is not very close, but why not see all the other ones that are so close?
The absence of knowledge about something from
something. Close your mic. Fix that.
Like when he introduced me, because you have the absence of your knowledge about who I was. Anyway, so right. Okay. So. Is there a mathematical structure in which we can bring in the beauty of the vector space model of meaning together with the beauty of the pre-group way of analyzing the syntax? And these guys both are compact loss categories, so why not work in a compact loss category? And everybody probably knows the definition by now from yesterday. So it's just that it's a Morella closed category, a compact closed, where it's an object has a left and a right adjoint. In this case, we are non-commutative. So we're going to have four units and co-units of adjunction, two units and two co-units, two etals for expansion, and two epsilons for contraction. And this is how we denote them. And we've got four yanking or combing axioms, etc. And a pre-group is compact closed. The types are objects. The elements of the pre-group are objects. The partial order is a morphism. It's like a thin category. Tensor is the juxtaposition of the types. The unit one is the empty type. Adjoints are the same adjoints. Epsilon maps are, as I said, contractions. Eta maps are expansions. And now we get the luxury of assigning a morphism to the syntactic structure of the sentence. Like if you'd work in a pre-group, all you know about Bob likes beer in a pre-group is that it is grammatical. But in a categorical way of looking at it, you get this guy as the morphism corresponding to the syntactic structure of the sentence, right? And it's particularly helpful to distinguish ambiguous sentences like, I saw a man with a telescope. Then you'll get two different morphisms for each different meaning, and you can distinguish them in the category, but not in the partial order, right? In the partial order, or you can say that, well, they're both grammatical. But here you see how they're different because you get two different morphisms. Anyway, so this guy is the morphism for Bob likes beer, corresponding to this picture. And that guy on top, so time goes from bottom to top. First, you do this line of epsilons, then you do the second line of epsilons, and the morphism corresponding to John, Bob does not like beer is that composition morphism guy on top. Yeah. Okay, so vector spaces are compact closed, finite dimensional vectors are compact closed. Just to recall, the objects are vector spaces, morphisms are linear map, tensor is tensor, adjoints are identity. And then Bob says that the epsilon maps are taking the inner product, yeah, and the eta maps create entangled states, which are important for non-local correlations in quantum mechanics. Okay, so we have a pre-group to analyze a language like English. And we have a vector space model to assign meaning to the words of English. Now, how do we assign, how do we connect the two? So the easy way is to think of a functor built on a free pre-group generated over the dictionary, T of D, into the category of finite dimensional vector spaces. And I'm going to force this functor to be strongly monoidal and send the left and right adjoints in the non-commutative free group to the single one in the vector spacer. Now, when I gave this talk a while ago, Louis Crane was in the audience, and he said that this is nothing but the quantization functor of attire, right? So we're quantizing the syntax in a way. Anyway, so, okay, so in our example, Bob liking and not liking beer, so let's just assign a V to the pair Bob and N, to the pair beer and N a W, and then pointwise we generate vector spaces, tensor spaces to the composite types like likes, like, does, and not. So J is for the J, and S is the vector space for S, and for beer and Bob, like N, and the right hand side N is V and W. Now I think we should aim to prove this as a theorem, but for now maybe it's just a guideline that the meaning vector, so we defined in a very nice way how a string of words is grammatical. Now what is the meaning vector of a string of words? So if you have a string of words in a language W1 to WN, each has a type of TI for each WI, and the composition of the types has a syntactic reduction map F to one of the designated types S. Now what's the meaning of this string of words, W1 to WN? And the big question before is, we want to make this compositional, we want to build this from the meaning of the individuals in the sentence, i.e. the meaning vector of each word in the sentence. So the answer is, that is, applying the composition of these two maps to the tensor of the vectors of the meaning of each word in the sentence, where F is the semantic vector applied to the syntactic reduction, and this eta bar is a sequence of eta maps that create Bell states. So it's always of this form. You take the syntax, but then you precompose it with some other things that provide you semantic applications of certain things. So in the case of Bob likes Pierre, there are no eta maps, so if you want to select identity, so you just take the map of the syntax, the epsilon V times 1S times epsilon W. This is the picture corresponding to it. I want to apply it to the tensor of the vectors of the words in my sentence. So for some people, this far is enough, but I need to put some concrete values. So assume Bob is a vector in V, beer in W, and likes that live in V tensor S tensor W, I can write as this typical element of a tensor space, the sum guy. Yeah. This is, and then Bob likes Pierre is applying that guy to this, which is really the sum, and then I apply epsilon to Bob and the variable VI in the sum, so it's the inner product here. And then I apply epsilon to beer and the WJ in like, so it's this inner product. I do nothing to S, keep it like that. Yeah? Yeah? So this is the meaning of Bob likes Pierre. Now, to make it more concrete, why not put some Boolean values to our sentence? And now we have the Montague semantics, if we can make a truth value meaning for the sentence. So assume V is spanned by all men. Bob is one of them. W is spanned by all drinks. Pierre is one of them. And S, the vector space of the sentence, is spanned by truth values, 0 and 1 for true and false. And now I can simplify like as this guy, right? A man, a drink, and some truth value. And the truth value is going to be 1 if the man likes the drink and 0 otherwise. And if Bob is man number 3 and the drink under consideration is drink number 4, Pierre is drink number 4, then I do my inner product, substitute Bob for the MI in likes, for the variable MI in likes, substitute beer for the variable DJ in likes, and this is simply S34, and then now I look in my map, it's true if Bob likes beer, and if it's false otherwise. So
the true theoretic meaning. But how about if we want to go more than true theoretic meaning? So why not talk about degrees of meaning and define like as 3/4 loving and 1/4 hating. So and then we define love and hate in a Boolean fashion as we did for like before, and make like now be spanned by vectors coming from love and hate. And now if we do the previous calculation, we can see that the meaning of Bob-like sphere is true if you 3/4 likes it and 1/4 hates it. So we get some sort of weighted meaning. How about the negative sentence? Now the syntactic reduction map does not suffice, and you have to do some precomposition by applying eta maps. So this is the guy that creates for you the eta maps that are necessary. And this is the guy coming from the syntactic reduction that is easy. But the precomposition of eta maps might be a bit harder. So this is the picture going with it. And what I'm doing is creating a Bell state between this V star and V. So how do you call it? Entangle this V star and V. Entangle these V star and V in the first step of calculation. In the next step, I'm going to entangle J and J star and S and J, assuming that S and J are the same. It's true that grammatically they have different types, but meaning-wise, the infinitive of a verb and the full form of the verb don't have different meanings. Like and likes do not really have different meanings. So I assume S and J are the same, and also entangle them in this way. Now, if I now compose this with the map of the syntactic reduction, as I showed you before, then I get this diagram that I showed to you at the beginning, right? Now the meaning of Bob does not like beer is now this morphism applied to the tensor of the meaning of each word in the sentence. And what is it? Well, let's define like as before. But now let's be a bit smart on not. Well, what is not? Well, it's something that really swaps the meaning. So why not use the not gate, red in the middle, in the part where when I correlated J and J star. So I've created a function from J to J, and what I'm going to ask it to do is to apply the not gate. And does, so here I think does doesn't change the meaning at all. So when I have a function from S to J, why not put the identity matrix, because it doesn't change the meaning. So now, what I'm really doing is putting functions on my two of my eta maps. I can get rid of the second one, of course, but just to focus. And using yanking, now I can show that this guy actually simplifies to that. Yeah, so I pull the string in the middle. And the little triangle is going to be a big triangle where you're 1, 2, 3 yankings. And this picture is equivalent to this matrix calculation, right? So I do first, I'm from top to bottom, this guy, which is nothing but the substitution in likes, which I've said before as being 1 or 0. Then I apply the not matrix here, and the identity matrix afterwards, which says the meaning of Bob does not like beer is true if Bob does not like beer, and it's false if Bob likes beer. Now, I was not sure if the pictures work, so I insisted to do the calculation. I made a lot of mistakes on the way. And this is one part of it, and this is the second part. So these sort of things convinced me that this is really much simpler than doing all these calculations. Right.
Which one do you prefer? Right, okay. So the same sort of calculation goes easily if you put degrees of love and hate on life. Then you can say, if at the beginning Bob likes Pierre with 3/4 and 1/4, if he doesn't like, then you swap the guys and 1/4 and 3/4. And needs, oh, and then for the first time in the history of computational linguistics, distributed model of meaning, we can compare meaning of sentences using the inner product, right? So Bob loves beer and Bob hates beer are not close to each other at all. Loving and liking are 3/4 close to each other. Do not liking and loving 1/4 close to each other. So the meaning that you put on the verb in this case, and on not and does in the negative case, sort of propagates through the meaning of the sentence to the inner product when you compare the meaning of sentences to each other. So this is a very good, if you want, consequence of our work. Right. So I want to finish by asking a question from the English speaking people. Why is it that when you say Bob, when somebody tells you Bob does not like beer, so you say it in this way, Bob does not like beer, but what you really mean is that take the relation between of liking between Bob and beer, negate it, and do nothing on it. So the order of the syntax is different from the order in the semantics, right? And this is the phenomenon that we had to solve using the eta maps, the Bell states. So in order to send Bob, which I heard at the beginning of the sentence, to like, which I heard towards the end of the sentence, all I have is a juxtaposition of types, which is not commutative, right? So I'm going to entangle Bob to does. This is what the string diagram tells you. Huh? Entangle Bob to does. Entangle does to not and not to like. And then swap this entanglement such that Bob will be entangled to like, right? And then I can apply liking to Bob and beer and not to this and does to this by the second line of the calculation. So I'm going to 5 minutes. So I want to say, okay, maybe, so there is some, so I'm just going to say, I'm not going to show the solution, but so our approach, we work in two dimensions, right? And we use the not gate to swap the basis to get the meaning, the negative meaning of the sentence. Well, this is okay for a sentence, Bob does not like beer. It will have the same meaning as Bob dislikes beer. Yeah, you agree? But if I would use the same not in the natural language and say it is not the case that Bob likes beer, it should not have the same meaning as Bob dislikes beer, right? But in two dimensions, with swapping the basis as a matrix for not, this happens. So then Lambeck told me that this is normal in natural languages. There are two kinds of negation, deducto and dire. Passive negation in is not, and an active negation in does not. And then I solved the problem by going to three dimensions. Now the notation is a bit sloppy, but instead of building Sij in two dimensions using true and false, build it in three dimensions using true, false, and no matter what in the middle, indifferent. And then you can come up with new matrices for the passive not, and you can show that if it is not the case that Bob likes beer, then it's either he dislikes it or he is indifferent to it. So we have a new negation, passive not. And the active not, that's the matrix corresponding to in the middle, you can put whatever. And then Bob does not like beer is the same as Bob dislikes beer. So we can also cater for all those other kinds of negations. Anyway, so let me summarize. So we have provided, we have built the first mathematical model for a compositional vector space model of meaning. It's also solves another open problem, that of providing semantics for pre-group grammar. And we showed how using string diagrams simplify the calculations to a great extent. So you type your sentence, if somebody gives you a sentence and asks you, what is the compositional meaning of this sentence? You type it in a pre-group grammar, get the meaning of the words from your technician in the vector space model, but be careful with the meaning of the words with compound types, like verbs, and interpret them as linear maps, which is not usually done in the vector space model. And then apply that guideline and I showed and get the meaning of the sentence. And what we are working now, I'm mainly active in the first line. So I think on not, we've done good amount of progress with different vectors, interpreting different ways of negation in natural languages. But how about the vectors for am or for all exist, etc.? Stephen Clark wants to implement this system to sort of evaluate if this model goes with the intuition of people about the meaning of a sentence. And then we want to apply our theory really to real life problems like information retrieval from the web, or more specialized texts such as in the court or in patent offices, when the vocabulary and the grammar is much more limited. And we're also writing an EPSRC grant among Oxford, Cambridge, Sussex, Edinburgh, and New York to do these things and many more.
Yeah, what happens if you try to calculate the meaning of a sentence? This sentence is false.
Oh, gee, I meant to say that for you. Yeah. So I have an answer. So if you want to force it to be a Gödel sentence, then it will become this type. So you will not come out of the loop. You can never say if it is true or false. It's this type.
And what does that sentence is false?
Well, yeah, so I treated this and that and all those guys, so I didn't, didn't put any, it would be the same for that, but one can make difference,
Okay, another question. Chris Barker, a linguist, was at UCSD, I'm not sure where he's at now, has looked at things like and for all, especially, for example, everyone likes beer. You can't just stick in the meaning of everyone into your clause likes. There's nothing you can put into that first slot that would capture everyone. You need for all x likes x here. Mm-hmm. And so he's captured that ability to stick something back at the front using continuations, which is the UNETA embedding. So I can point you to some of that.
I'm sure we can do that, but we can also do more, because we're not under any for sets.
It's pretty general.
Yeah, that's what I would think for the meaning of everyone. It's like for all. That's what we call competition.
Yeah, so everyone likes beer. It's for all X likes X beer. So there's nothing to put in the first slot that captures that for all. Let's shift it out to the front. That's where the
question is. So doesn't every mean for all?
Yes, but you don't say likes for all x, x, comma beer. That for all has to be at the beginning of the proposition.
Yeah, so it just depends both states then to move for all from the beginning to.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Andreas is going to say a few words about the news program.
What was the name of the
guy? Let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.